With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're happier and more relaxed and in a good headspace, then you're going to do a better job. I think that would apply to almost any job I can think of.
Welcome to the Humorology Podcast with me, Paul Barros, and my glittering lineup of guests from the worlds of business, sport, and entertainment who are going to share their wisdom and their use of humor with you. Humorology is the study of how humor can dramatically improve your business and your life. Humorology puts the fun into business fundamentals, increases the value of your laughing stock, and puts a punchline back into your bottom line. Please remember to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. My guest on this edition of the Humorology Podcast is a multi-award-winning author, television screenwriter, and performer. He is in the pantheon of hugely successful crime writers, and his output is not only prodigious, but prolific, having produced around 30 publications in just over 20 years. He's also the world's only best-selling author to have had a successful career as a stand-up comedian, actor, and musician. He draws a fascinating parallel between performing comedy and writing crime fiction, and has said, crime novels are full of punchlines. They're just very dark punchlines. Mark Billingham, welcome to the Humorology Podcast.
It's very nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. How much of a help was a background in comedy to writing the dark punchlines of crime fiction?
Oh, it was hugely helpful. I don't think I realised that it would be. It took me a few years to realise quite how helpful it had been. I mean, you know, firstly, from a very basic standpoint, as you know, you've got to engage that audience very quickly. You know, you can't walk on stage at the Comedy Store and go, stick with me, I'll get funny in about 10 minutes. You've got to be funny straight away or they'll throw bottles at you. And similarly with a book, you know, I mean, I will give a book 20 pages. And if something hasn't engaged me in that 20 pages, a voice, a hook, or something, I'm going to put it down and pick up something else. That writer hasn't done their job. So firstly, I learned that about, you know, hitting very hard and keeping it going and keeping the pages turning in the way you have to keep the laughs coming. But just in terms of the way crime fiction is structured, it's all about timing. It's all about the reveal. You know, it's all about that moment, similar to a joke where the audience think the punchline is coming from one direction, then it hits them from somewhere else. And that happens in crime fiction all the time. You know, the revelation of a killer, the, you know, a clue, a red herring, a body, whatever it might be. So yeah, all sorts of punchlines in crime fiction. But like I said, in you know, as you referenced in your intro, very dark ones most of the time.
For our listeners, we worked on the same circuit for a goodly amount of time. We were actually, funnily enough, somebody described it to me. I said I was having you on. And a friend of mine, when I told him I was interviewing you, he said, weren't the Calypso twins and the Tracy brothers like the Blur and Oasis of the comedy circuit in the 80s and 90s?
We certainly never got booked on the same bill together. There was only usually room for, if it was a big benefit or something, but most of the time there was only room for one musical comedy double act. I think I might have worked with you later when I was a solo act, if I was comparing or something.
As you compared us a few times, you were a great compare at the Store and Jongleurs as well. I'm just wondering, if we were Blur and Oasis, does that make the Rubber Bishops Pulp?
It was a bit of a heyday. It was a bit of golden time for the musical comedy double act, wasn't it? But in the way of all things, they end up splitting up. They always do.
Well, when it's bands, isn't it, basically?
Yeah.
musical differences. No, we didn't have any. Ainsley and I are still best mates, so that's good. Are you still in touch with Mike?
I don't really see Mike very much. Again, we never had a falling out. He just went in a different direction. He's a teacher now, and I haven't seen him for a long time. I haven't seen, you know, occasional exchange on social media, but that's about it.
I mean, because you're so successful as a rock crime writer now, do you have a sort of a real want to get back on stage regularly?
Well, I do that. I get my performance jollies all the time at book festivals. I mean, I'm always drawn to the more comedic side of things, even though the books are largely very dark. I do a two-man show with a writer called Chris Brookmeyer, who's a writer of who's a hugely funny man. I got him into doing some stand-up at the Store once, and we do a show together that is purely for laughs. I mean, it's pure scatological nonsense for laughs. And I'm a member of a band with a bunch of other crime writers, and
I
absolutely need that stage time. I still really need that. What I miss is the 20 minutes on stage or the 40 minutes on stage. What I don't miss is sitting in a grotty dressing room at 2 a.m. You know, I don't miss any of that.
Yeah, that's where we know that there's no glamour in that bit. And having spent years in those grotty dressing rooms, and which are sometimes not even dressing rooms. You remember the old dressing room at the Leicester Square Comedy Store, which was literally...
Absolutely, I do. Where the toilet was the sink. I remember walking in there one day and seeing a very famous female comedian who I shall not name pissing in the sink, thinking, oh, that's showbiz.
Yes, welcome to show business. It was great. So what makes you laugh, Mark?
So I was thinking about this. I mean, right now, the thing that makes me laugh, or the person that makes me laugh, and it's a joy, is my son Jack, who is 23, and we laugh all the time. And there's something very special about, I mean, it's not just the laugh, isn't it? You can laugh at a joke. You can laugh at a joke you read in a book or that somebody says on TV, but there's something about the company you're in, there's something about the context that makes the laugh that much more precious. And when he makes me laugh and I laugh, but I'm also enormously proud of him. I'm kind of enormously proud that he has such a great sense of humour. I mean, I think if there's one thing you can pass on to your kids, if it's that, you know, you've done your job. And he makes me laugh all the time. I mean, that thing about context is funny. I don't know if you've ever seen this. I'm sure you have. There's a video I saw once where it's comedy. The camera is on the audience at a comedy club. It may well even have been the Comedy Store. And the joke is told, and then they show the reaction in slow motion of like 600 people laughing. And what you see is people checking out the people next to them. It's a fraction of a second. It's just the eyeballs move. It's just, it's kind of, can we all laugh? It's that shared, you know, it's that communal experience of laughter, which is very different from when you read something, when you laugh out loud at something on the telly when it's just you. That's a very odd moment. But yeah, my son makes me laugh a lot.
Yeah, it's funny that, you know, because we're recording this in lockdown, and when we go back, I mean, you can't really get an atmosphere for comedy unless people are tightly packed in.
Well, there are a lot of comics I know now who are doing the gigs on Zoom, and it's just the weirdest experience. I mean, not only is there no direct interaction, sometimes they can't even hear. Even if people are on a screen laughing, they can't hear it. And it's just telling jokes into the ether. You know, it's just the most bizarre experience.
So is there any chance of your son Jack going into comedy?
I think it's just the way he is. I'm not sure he knows what he's going to go into. But he will always look for the gag. He will always look for the gag. And it's a great instinct, that.
It is. Well, by the way, my son Sam is the same. It's a joy. But then we get into is humour nature or nurture? And is growing up in an environment where you've got a funny dad, or is it something that you hear? I mean, the Jesuits say, give me a child of 7 and I will give you the man. Was the young Mark Billingham funny?
Probably not. I certainly didn't grow up in a house where, you know, neither my dad or later my stepdad were, you know, comedically inclined. We'd watch all the classic sitcoms on telly. Once I got to school, yeah, I'd love to say I was the class clown. It wasn't quite that. I mean, that's such a cliche. But when it came to anything written, you know, that thing when you had to write a story in class, the golden moment for me, I mean, the absolute golden moment was if the teacher said, Mark, come and read your story out to the rest of the class. That was the best thing that could ever happen. I mean, I can still remember just how exciting that was. And I was trying to be funny. I remember trying to write an in inverted commas funny story for my 11 plus English exam, and I remember my teacher, Mr. Turnbull, apparently took my mother aside and said, well, I think what Mark's done is funny, you know, fingers crossed the examiner does. Yeah, I think that was always my first instinct, was to try and make people laugh, I think.
So you would go that it's more nature than nurture, would you? That you have to hear funny, because that's the way I think about it, because neither of my parents were particularly funny, but you start to hear it, don't you? And you just know where the bag is.
My brother doesn't have that kind of instinct either. You know, he likes a good laugh, but he's not always looking for the joke. You know exactly what I mean. I mean, the odd thing is, in terms of the books I write now, I have to resist that quite often, because, you know, I write about a detective who is not a smart ass. He's not full of jokes. He'll think of the joke 3 days later. There are some other characters who bring humour into it, but it's not necessarily him. So sometimes I go, oh, that would be a great thing to say. That'd be a very funny thing to say. But it's not him. It's just not him. So I have to, quite often fight that urge to put gags in right, left and centre.
Are there any serial killers who in books who have great senses of humour?
Well, yes. I mean, probably most notably Dexter, which then became a huge successful TV series. Those books are very funny. I mean, I think later on we'll probably talk about, is there anything that isn't funny? And I mean, arguably, you know, death is right up there as a kind of, but you have to be funny about it. You kind of have to. I mean, there are whole books, and I've got a lot of books about, funny books about death. But if you want to hear jokes flying thick and fast, you go to a murder scene, you know, which I have attended. And cops have to have very black senses of humour. It's a coping mechanism. It's the only way. You can't take all that death and grief and pain and loss and darkness home with you at the end of the day. You know, it's a really interesting thing. And I've spent whole nights out on night shift drive-alongs with cops. And the stuff they come out with is just unbelievable, because they know that 2 minutes later they're going to be attending a fatal road traffic accident or a murder or whatever. It's a very strange thing to experience.
Well, it's gallows humour, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Yeah, funny, we had people on the podcast. We had John Sweeney, for instance, on the podcast, who has been to 60 wars and insurrections and everything. And he talked about that everybody in war was funny to cope, and as a coping mechanism.
Yeah. And I've interviewed a lot of, worked a lot with a number of pathologists, sort of fairly high profile pathologists, who've worked on some just horrendous, horrendous cases. And they're some of the funniest and most entertaining and creative people that you'd ever wish to meet. It's really bizarre, which is why I made, you know, the only ostensibly funny character in my books is a pathologist, just because those people just tend to have very, very dark senses of humour.
Tell me a funny story about something that's happened to you.
I was doing a book event a few years ago in Ireland, and I had a book that was about to come out, wasn't ready. There weren't finished copies of it, but what I had were little samplers. The publisher had created a whole bunch of samplers, thousands of these little, only about yay thick, 3 or 4 chapters, and I was giving them away during the tour. So every night I would do these events, and I would say, okay, well, there'll be a Q&A at the end, and any great questions, I'll give you a copy of the sample. So we got to the Q&A at the end, and a guy put his hand up on the front row and said, I want to talk to you about Audible, your audiobooks. I really like your audiobooks. I listen to them all the time, and you narrate them. You know, what's it like narrating your own audiobook? So I talked about that for a bit, and I thought that was a great question. And I said, oh, well done. That's a great question. Here you go. You win a sampler. And I picked it up, and I threw it at him. And as it left my hand, I mean, in that split second as it left my hand, I went, he's blind. Of course, that's why he loves the audiobooks so much. But it was too late. It was like, ah, you know, that awful slow motion thing. And of course, the thing just hit him. And it was just horrendous. I mean, you kind of turn it into a funny story, and then you tell it. I mean, that's happened with a lot of awful things that have happened at book events. You save those stories up and then turn them into a routine. But that was about the worst.
Yeah. And it's no wonder comedians call it dying when they fail on stage, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Well, talking about being on stage and dying, what's the worst heckle you've ever had?
What about the worst death heckle? I can remember? Well, the worst death I can remember was very late, closing the late show at Jonglers, Camden, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning or something. And you know that thing when you walk out, they just look at you and go, we've had enough. And you know instantly, you just know you're doomed. So I did about 5 minutes to virtual silence and total apathy, thinking this is going to be a nightmare. And then there was a person right at the front who turned out to be, I think he was Polish, you know, where are you from, desperately trying anything, and he turned out he was Polish. So I just started asking him what was the Polish for different things, for rude words. I mean, it was just rubbish, it was pathetic. But I started to get a hint of a reaction from the audience, and I thought, you know, you have that little moment of optimism when you think, I can turn this around. So I start going, what's Polish for this? What's Polish for penis? What's Polish for this? And then a bloke at the back just going, what's Polish for your shit? That's the one I have nightmares about. And you know, sometimes it's just, to be honest, that wasn't a gig where it was a death where it was my fault. Sometimes it is, you know, sometimes you're just, when you're doing four gigs a night and you mess up and you really shouldn't have taken on that much work. But when you just walk on and they're tired and there's nothing you can do, that's the kind of work. In a way, you'd almost rather get somebody shouting at you than hearing nothing. And you get those genius comedians, and you know the ones I mean, people like Bill Bailey or Sean Locke, or, you know, I don't know about you, but you and I would get a heckle and something in you freezes. You don't want it. You know, you say, I've got this 20 minutes of material. I know it works. I don't want this heckle. And something in you freezes. When they get heckled, something in them is liberated. It's like you watch them come to life and you watch them go, oh, let's have some fun. Let's play. You know, they're a rare breed.
Yeah, oh, they are a rare breed, the ones who will really, because, I mean, actually, with experience, you do learn that actually it's not what you say, it's how you say it, you know, and we all had a few stock heckle put-downs in our back pocket, you know, when I want any more shit from you, I'll squeeze your head, you know, what do you use for birth control? Is it your personality, you know?
And of course, the thing to remember is not only do you do it for a living, you've got a microphone, there are big bouncers at the back of the room, they're drunk. I mean, you know, 9 times out of 10, you will beat the heckler. But some heckles, you know, you remember the genius heckles, you know, good evening, I'm a schizophrenic. Well, the pair of you can fuck off. You know, you just got to give in at that point and go, you win.
Do you remember the one of, I can't remember which comic went on with the microphone and said, can you hear me? And the heckler said, yes, I can, but I'm willing to change places with someone who can't.
And there was a comedian who came on stage at the Comedy Store, sort of open spot, who spent 5 minutes miming. Just miming, just all this and talking against the wind, and then a heckler went, "Oi, speak up! I'm blind." And then waited a couple of minutes, and went, "Has he gone yet?" That was the killer.
Oh, the kicker!
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. There were some. I mean, did you play the Tunnel Palladium as well?
Mm-hmm.
Which it was legendary for our listeners in the sense that Malcolm Hardy used to wind up the audience deliberately.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we had to stop playing it when we went on to racist chanting at one stage. So.
Well, we stopped playing it when a comedian got hit with a glass. I'm trying to remember who it was. It might have been Kit Hollaback. Anyway, I know somebody got hit with a glass and there was a bit of a movement that people went, we should just boycott this place for a while. Because, yeah, Malcolm would wind them right up. And they, you know, Malcolm. And they would, it's like they would rehearse heckles. I'm quite convinced that the audience got together an hour before the show and just, it was gladiatorial. Really was.
It was a zoo, basically. It really was. Is everyone capable of being funny, Mark? Or because everybody in their profile, when they're looking for dates, will put good sense of humour. But
no, I don't think they are. In the same way that if you can carry a tune, you find it quite astonishing when somebody is tone deaf. You've just sort of go, how can you think you're in tune? Or if you can dance and you see somebody who can't dance, who basically just has no sense of rhythm, and you just go, but that's sort of, surely everybody understands rhythm. I mean, it's in us, it's innate. But then you see somebody dancing and you go, nope, you're just not getting this at all. And I think therefore there are people who just can't tell a joke. You know, couldn't tell the best joke in the world and get a laugh out of it because their timing's all over the place. They don't embroider it in the right way, whatever it might be. You know, this is an interesting thing. This is right up your alley, I would imagine, in terms of the book. When I first started writing, because of the background, I thought I should maybe write some comedy crime. I maybe, you know, and there are some comedy. And back then there were a couple of moderately successful comedy crime writers, Carl Hyerson, an American notably, but very few. And I remember at one of the first conventions I went to, there was a seminar called Does Humor Hurt Your Sales Figures? I've never forgotten that. And the reason for it is this, why there are so few humor, I mean, genuinely humor, well-known humorous writers. you know, which is really sad, you know, being the country that produced P.G. Woodhouse and Evening War or whatever it might be, that there are so few. And the reason for it is this. An editor gets sent something that is, this is a funny book. And either they go, well, I think it's funny, but will anybody else? Or this might be the funniest thing in the world, but I don't get it. So the easiest thing in the world is to pass. It's they're very scared of funny books. And that's the same thing I think applies to basically, you know, it's like tell 10 people the same joke. 8 of them will laugh their socks off and 2 of them will stare at you. It's, so I think no is, that's a very long-winded way of saying no. I don't think everybody can be funny.
So for our listeners, because we're trying to give them tips and techniques, how is there a way to become funnier?
Again, I kind of don't think so. I mean, you know, there are plenty of people taking comedy workshops and running comedy, been going for donkey's years and produced a whole load of great comedians. But I believe those great comedians would always have been great comedians. I think what they're taught is, you know, microphone technique and, you know, the way to build a routine or, you know what I mean? You plumb into themselves a bit more and use their own experience for their material. But I don't think you can teach somebody. It's like teaching somebody who's got no sense of rhythm to have a sense of rhythm. You can't teach it. You either hear it or you don't. So I don't think you can be taught to be funny. In the same way that I don't think you can be taught to be a good writer. You can become a better writer. You can weed out bad habits and you can learn discipline and you can, all that kind of stuff. But you can't teach somebody how to write. It's a craft. You can get better at it. But I don't think you can. I don't think if it's not in you, there's got to be something in you to begin with. Yeah, you can get better. You can get to a certain level. You can get to a sort of acceptable level. But I think if you want to go beyond that, there's got to be something fairly special there to begin with.
If somebody's got to make a speech, whether that's a wedding speech or a business speech, what's the advice? Because actually, I get brought in sometimes to help with CEOs making speeches. And most of the time, I'm telling them not to do the funny. And they're going, I need to start with a joke. And I'm going, well, unless you can really nail it, it could, you know, the worst thing is it dies on its ass and then you go, but seriously,
yeah,
you know.
My closest friend is a comedian called Mike Gunn, and I was the best man at his wedding. In front of a room full of comedians, like 100 comedians, yeah. And you all know all of them. And I was absolutely wetting myself back there waiting to go on. And they were like animals. They were just, here comes the best man speech. They were rubbing their hands with glee. And as soon as I sort of took to the stage, they all crowded round like jackals, you know. And so I just went sincere. I put a couple of cheap put downs in and then just went sincere. And you could see them all sort of go, oh. I'm not going to do that. I think you're right. I mean, you go online and you see these how to write best man speeches and there are all these hackneyed old jokes, you know. Well, this is the second time today I've got up from a warm seat with a piece of paper in my hand, which, God bless him, my late father-in-law said at our wedding. I'm kind of blessing for that.
Post-ironically, of course.
No. Absolutely not.
I think that, I mean, that's a great piece of advice, I think, is go sincere. At my wedding, I had a load of comics there as well. So making my speech was, I was heckled in my own speech.
I know.
Which was like, and I was thinking, yeah, okay, that I deserve this.
I mean, I did it, I've been lucky enough to be a best man a few times, and most recently it was a fellow crime writer. So the room was full of crime writers who are not, you know, some of them are absolutely hilarious, but most of them aren't. You know, because it's just not what they do. So I, you know, I put a lot of work into this speech. And if I say so myself, it was pretty funny. It was, you know, but people talk about it like, I've never seen a that was the best man speech I've ever seen. Because actually, they're not used to seeing somebody who has done this professionally know kind of how to work a room. And it's and working the room, which is a very different thing from telling a joke. Oh. You know, it's not they're not the same skill necessarily, but.
Yeah, so how does somebody get better at working the room that you can't unless you do a lot of it, presumably?
Well, you know, again, it's things like it's stage time. You just need stage time. But of course, again, in terms of some comedians, it's in their nature and it's in their stage persona that they don't move, for example. And they're just they're one-liner merchants, just stand at the microphone and don't. Whereas I was always a prowler, just prowling around stage. And especially when you compare, that really is your job. Working the room literally means making contact with as many people in that room as you can. Even if that's a hack thing of going, right, all the women in the room, where are you? All the men in the room, all the married couples, all the single people, all that stuff. You know, none of it's rocket science, really.
So you say that, but that's an art as well. I mean, to be a good compere is really difficult, I think. And there's only... And in our time, I think there were perhaps seven good compares. So, I mean, it was a real art to be able to do it. And we would name all the same people because as an act, when it kicked off or somebody died on their arse, you relied on the compere to bring them back.
Yeah.
But so, was your drama background, because I know that you obviously acted, but you also had a drama degree. Was that helpful in that stage presence and understanding?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly meant that I wasn't shy. I mean, it is so much about confidence, or rather making the audience think that you're confident. I mean, there's that crucial 10 seconds, you know, literally from when the compere goes, so please welcome, and they clap, and they and there's that moment when you take the stage and take the microphone out of the mic stand, and that is absolutely crucial. And it's about saying to the audience, relax, I know what I'm doing. You know, you're in safe hands. And there are some comics that just seem to have a natural way of making the audience go, oh, I so want to laugh at you. You're going to make me laugh. And there are some comics who rub people up the wrong way and they walk on and the audience go, right, make me laugh. You know, I am going to resist, you know, the urge to laugh as long as I possibly can. But it is about that confidence thing. And I think I had that from, you know, trolling around doing bloody Shakespeare all over the country or doing a touring theatre company for a couple of years. Having said that, the very first time I was booked at the Comedy Store, I remember seeing a fine comic called Dave Cohen, who'd been going for years before I was, vomiting in the dressing room. And I thought, oh my God, he's been doing this years and he's listening to the Late Show crowd baying outside the door and he's chucking up and I'm going, oh my God. So yeah, I mean, it's not the same thing as walking on at the, you know, the Theatre Royal Windsor. It's a very different experience.
Well, it's funny because I always say that if you've worked the Late Show at the Comedy Store, nothing is ever scary again. Are you of the same mind?
Yeah, pretty much. It is the scariest thing. It is absolutely the scariest thing. When, as you say, I mean, they're only a few feet away, you know, you can literally the other side of this door, and yeah, you can hear them baying. You'd hear them baying for blood. It's such a weird industry, isn't it? Because your best friend can be on before you, and there's a little nasty part of you going, I want you to die. Because if you absolutely rip the arse out of this for 20 minutes, I can't follow you. Similarly, you know, it's very awful, isn't it? We've all been in that dressing room when someone has died, and when they come through that door, and we all look at the floor.
Everybody's head goes down. You can't look at them. You don't want to be infected by
it
that.
It's very weird moving from that to publishing, because I remember going to my first kind of publishing award ceremony about a year after I'd started. And somebody had just won the award for, I don't know, whatever it was, best new writer, and walked up to stage. And I looked around and there was genuine warmth and congratulations. And I remember thinking, if this was comedy, this was a comedian getting up there, you know, the bitching would have started before he'd got to the stage. He's got that much talent. Damn,
never been fun.
Way fun. It's competitive by nature because of that way evenings are structured. You know, it's not like, you know what it's like, four acts and a compere. They don't all get together in the dressing room beforehand and go, let's have a great show, everybody. There isn't, it's not like a team, you know. It's great if everybody does well, but it's also quite good if somebody doesn't, quite often, in terms of the audience having a good evening. You know, three storming acts and one hideous death. What a great night. So, well, most writers don't subscribe to the belief that in order for them to do well, somebody else has to do badly. It tides all boats will rise on a tide kind of thing. And so they're a nice crowd, nice gang to be a member of.
Do you know what? As a psychologist now, I go and speak at conferences and everything and like that. And very rarely does anybody say you're shit.
That's right. I mean, people might not like my book, but they don't throw it at me. You know, I don't get people at the you know, Hey Literary Festival going, taxi! I don't get that. It's much better. You know,
once this has gone out, you might encourage people.
I will. They were the worst heckles, the kind of knowing heckles.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the great heckles we've already mentioned, you know, the creative heckles. When somebody just goes, next, it's like, oh.
Yeah. But do you remember in the Comedy Store days when Kim Kinney, because the Comedy Store, Kim Kinney, for our listeners, used to run the Comedy Store. He used to, I didn't find this out till later, but when he felt the audience was too quiet and wasn't involved, he used to walk along the back and start the heckling himself, the bastard. Yeah. God rest his soul. But
not a surprise.
and everything. But that's just so our listeners can understand what kind of atmosphere we grew up in. What would the world be like without humour?
Oh, it would be unbearable. I mean, it would be absolutely unbearable. On a very simple, personal, prosaic level, I can't read anything that doesn't have some humour in it. I can't write anything that doesn't have any humour in it. Because the world is like that. You know, even in the bleakest moments, there's humour. Because there has to be. Because it's the way we cope as human beings. I always have this image in my head, I don't quite know where it came from, of somebody walking away from the worst thing that they could possibly be going through. I don't know, identifying the body of their child, walking away from the mortuary and slipping on a banana skin. There has to be those moments. And in a way, in order for the dark to be truly dark, there has to be light. So you can compare the two. I can't bear things where there isn't some humour in there somewhere. There has to be. Oh, my God, it'd be an awful world. It'd be an awful world.
Do you think it's a part of the human condition that we have to, because we are one of only a few species that actually do involve humour? I know there's rats, but is that the release valve that we actually need to be human, you think?
Yes, I think it is. And I think it's probably part of the evolutionary process in terms of us becoming, in inverted commas, civilized. You know, I'm sure the first time, you know, a caveman hits himself on the thumb with his club, you know, and his mate laughed, you know, that was a massive step forward in human evolution. You know, up to that point, it's probably we've got to go and kill that mammoth or we're not going to eat tonight, or we've got to avoid getting killed by the saber-toothed tiger. But as soon as there was some sitting around a fire and having a laugh, then I think that's a giant evolutionary step, you know.
Yeah, no, I agree. So can people be good communicators?
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Without a level of humour?
No, I don't think so. Although, having said that, there's nothing worse than the kind of communicator who tries and fails to put humour in or you know, crowbars it in when it's not appropriate. I mean, I don't know how many of the people watching this or listening to this will have had to sit through the horror of a road traffic awareness speed course. Those courses you're offered instead of having points on your licence.
No,
I've done them twice. In a way, I just want this person to go to show me all the PowerPoints and go 30 miles an hour, you know, where are the hazards on this? But when they go, and it reminds me of when I was driving along one day and they try to tell you some joke and it just falls horrendously flat. And you just go, you're making this worse. Just get it over with. But when it's done well, I mean, it is a way to make things that might not be palatable, palatable, to make your audience a bit more receptive, to relax them, to make them feel that they're in a safe environment and that it's, you know, not going to be horrible.
It's fine when it's done well, but I mean, it's like aircrew who now think that they've got this is my crowd.
Yeah, yeah.
And you go, why? You know, look, there will be occasional ones who you go, oh yeah, I've not heard that. That's fine. That's lightening it up. But there's people who are going, I'm on.
Yeah, well, I flew on an airline once in Canada, a small Canadian airline, where that was their thing. It was sort of the gimmick of the airline. So the whole point, for the minute you got on the plane, they wouldn't stop. Even the not just the crew, you know, oh, I can't get my life jacket on, but the pilot, you know, we'll be flying at the height of 30,000 feet. Well, hopefully. And you just go, stop, just stop it now.
So, did you ever get invited to it? Because both my previous band, Morris Minor and the Majors, and the Calypso Twins, we used to work with Virgin Atlantic.
Yeah. We never did it. We talked about it once, but we never. It sounded horrendous to me.
Oh, well, by the way, just the noise, because you weren't allowed amplification.
Right.
And then you were stuck literally right in front of the person who wanted to sleep. You know, and you're going, do you want to boogaloo very, very loudly in their ear?
Who came up with that idea? Who thought that was a good idea? I mean,
well actually, it was Branson, because we did some of the inaugural flights to like Miami and places like that, and it was about making it fun. And I mean, some people loved it, and some people, but you imagine if you're forced to be in there. It's a tough one, but it was interesting experience, and I got to go to America a lot as a result of it. So you described yourself in another interview as a shameless show off. Mm. Is that, I mean, welcome to the club, but is that a gene you think that we have, that you need that feedback loop?
Yes, I think it is. And it's interesting, you were talking about, when I was talking about my son and you were talking about your son, that thing about, is it genetic? What my son has always, the thing I hated being told as a child, hated, was stop showing off. It was a thing that would cut me. It would cut me to the quick. You know, you'd know if you'd done something wrong, if you'd broken something or stolen something, but stop showing off just felt such, it was crushing. And I remember vowing to myself that if and when I had children, I would never, ever say that to them, ever. Well, largely because showing off has, you know, been my career pretty much in one form or another. Who the hell would I be to say that? But I think it's a terrible thing to say to somebody. But it is, in a way, comedy, stand-up comedy is sort of the word. There's something kind of desperate about love me, love me, love me. Not just laugh at me, but love me, love me. It's kind of a weird thing. But I'm still performing now when I write the books. The books are a performance. You're still trying to give the best performance you can. And yeah, shameless show-off, drop of a hat, fridge opening, all the, I mean, I'm absolutely, have always been that. And it's what it always said on my school report. Mark would do a lot better if he stopped showing off.
Well, no, but in a sense, I mean, for our listeners to take away, we had Dr. Richard Bandler on the podcast, who developed the field of NLP. And he said the problem is, and you just said it, you said you swore that you would never tell your son not to, or daughter not to show it off, not to be a show off. But it gets knocked out of people, because actually most of us in life, whatever you're doing, need to interact with people, need to, you know, make a speech, need to inspire people. So a bit of showing off is a good thing if you know how much it needs in the mix.
One of the things, when I'm swept to power and tired of popular opinion and I get to organise the education policy in this country, one of the things I would make compulsory at school is public speaking. I don't mean you have to become part of the debating society, but everybody at some point in their life will be, whether it's a wedding speech, whether it's at a business conference, whether it will have to stand up in front of 10 people or 20 people or 1,000 people and make a speech. I'm not saying you need to be turned into a master at that, but you need to have the fear of that taken away from you. So it's not the most dreadful and frightening thing you've ever done.
My theory on this is, having spent a lot of time and lived in America, is that Americans are much easier with this for that very reason, because they're all taught to do show and tell from a very young age.
Yeah.
And it's a very simple thing. You have to bring in something and go,
a frog or a, whatever it is.
And then you get over that. And as we know, fear of public speaking is the number one fear in the world. And as Jerry Seinfeld pointed out, that death is only number six. Is it important to be able to laugh at yourself?
Oh, 100%. I mean, the people I have always respected the most in whatever field I've worked in, so television, comedy, but largely in writing and publishing, are the people who take what they do enormously seriously, but don't take themselves remotely seriously. I think that's the only way to be. I mean, it's very simple. You can sum it up quite easily by just saying, don't be a dick. Don't take yourself too seriously.
People who can laugh at themselves actually have a degree of understanding about the ridiculousness of wherever you are on that hierarchy. It is ridiculous. I think
it also helps if you're surrounded by a family who laugh at you. I mean, literally will laugh at you when you're going, oh, look at this amazing review I've got in the Times. We'll then just go, yeah, but it's not as good as he got, or you're there, and just make you go, yeah, all right, I'm being an arse.
Kids are great for that, aren't they?
Oh, yes. Shut up, where's my tea?
Exactly. No, it just reminded me of a story. My mother's family are from the East End of Glasgow, so sort of. And when Morris Minor and Majors had their first hit, I went up to Glasgow and I was doing a gig up, and I went to the Cranhill estate where my family lived, and my little cousins all gathered around me, and I was preening myself slightly, and one of them came up to me and went, oh, Uncle Paul, we saw you on that there Top of the Pops. And I just allowed me to puff my chest out enough and went, we thought you were Shane.
Yeah, that's important.
Thank you. But a little smirk on their faces. They knew what they were doing, and it was beautiful.
Yeah.
Do people laugh enough, do you think, in the workplace generally?
I think people probably laugh less than they did, because I think people are possibly afraid to laugh, that maybe it's unseemly or it's not businesslike or, and you certainly can't laugh at people in the sort of way you're talking about. I mean, you know what I mean? Somebody trips over a stapler and, crashes into a door, you laugh at them, and the next thing you're being hauled up in front of HR for bullying. So I do, I do think there's room for more of it. Definitely. And I'm not sure there's as much as there was.
But how do you encourage it more? Because that's the whole Humorology project is built around. How do we actually get more laughter back into life and work?
Well, it clearly comes from people who are running departments. It's got to come from the top down, I think. And again, my experience of this is limited, because I am my own boss and I work from home. But whenever I'm in the publishing environment and I'm in their offices and stuff, it's a very happy and open, it's all, hot desking and open plan and all that sort of stuff. And everybody's encouraged to, contribute ideas and whatever. But when it comes to actually, I'm not in there largely when I am if the meeting's about me and there are meetings with, big slides and all sitting at a long table and so on. And there's always plenty of jokes, actually. There are jokes flying thick and fast. But what I notice is it's almost like it needs me to be the one that goes, it's all right, everybody can laugh. Somebody needs to say that. If this is a meeting that's about me or the marketing for my next book, that has to come from me. Because if I sit there and I go, right, let's see the facts and figures, what's the buy-in from Tesco or what are Waterstones doing this year, then it all gets very serious. Jokes and laughter flying around the table, but somebody needs to flick that switch and go, this is okay.
So that's leadership, isn't it? So leadership through laughter. It's like, somebody has to lead and go, this is okay.
Yeah. I think there is still a perception that it is not a natural thing to do in a business environment. That we have to be serious. I think there's still a perception that seriousness equates to efficiency, which is clearly not the case. But, I think that's still a widely held belief.
If I asked you to make a business case for humour, what would you include in it?
We all know that laughing, in terms of what it does to release endorphins and sense of well-being and happiness and stuff, that has to equate to doing your job better. I mean, surely. I mean, again, that doesn't seem like rocket science to me. If you're happier and more relaxed and in a good headspace, then you're going to do a better job. I think that would apply to almost any job I can think of.
But the trouble is that I think now that businesses are more and more getting run by accountants. Mm-hmm. And so there has to be a spreadsheet that says, you know, here's what we get for this. I can't see any uplift through laughter. So yeah. What's my return on investment? How do you define return on investment on that?
No, I think it's almost impossible. You have a whole bunch of people, you know, I always imagine sort of like a Kafka-esque scene where, you know, hundreds of people all sitting at a desk doing that. But once every 5 minutes, a joke is broadcast, you know, over a PA system. And, you know, then the next day there are no jokes and you basically see, well, you know, what was productivity like on each of these days? You know, that's probably not a fair way to do it. You'd actually need Billy Connolly standing up and doing 5 minutes of material once an hour or something. And there are other ways to do that. It doesn't have to be humour, but humour is certainly one of the things that would do that.
We say humour, but it's really lightness, isn't it? You're in a creative environment. Surely you have to reach that state of mind whereby you're allowed to play. And humour is about part of that playing process, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I know there's a lot of that goes on at my publisher. They encourage kind of evenings out and quiz nights and comedy clubs and whatever it might be. And that's about bonding, I suppose.
So have you ever taken a joke too far?
Oh, almost certainly. I can't think of a particular example, but probably. No, not probably, definitely. And there are times when you wake up the next day and go, I wish I hadn't said that. You know, where you just think there's one more laugh here. You know, it's that thing of just trying to wring every single laugh out of the thing. And you're not happy with one laugh, two laughs. You think I can get three, four out of this. And then, you know, you realise you said the wrong thing and you should have shut up.
But isn't that the whole learning process of comedy? Isn't that that you have to be pushing the boundaries because otherwise, you know, you won't know where they are.
But yeah, pushing boundaries. Yeah, you have to push boundaries. It's a good thing largely. But I suppose once it becomes personal, I'd be thinking of instances which were not professional. I'd be thinking of instances with a group sitting around with a group of friends in the pub.
Okay.
And then somebody a week later going, I was quite upset when you said that thing. And you go, it was just a stupid joke. And I don't mind upsetting people in a comedy audience. And I remember once when the Iraq War was on, when I was still in a double act, and we did a huge medley about the Iraq War, which was, it used to storm it most nights, you know, to the themes of American musicals, you know, the American army is coming out over the plane. I can't remember what it was. It was all really nonsense, but it used to go down really well. And then one night at a club, there was a knock on the door and a woman was in tears, hugely upset because her son was out there. You know, I don't want to come out for a night at the comedy club and have that thrown at me. And I was really sorry the woman was upset. But I was also thinking, you really think the best way to avoid the biggest story in the world right now is to go and listen to a bunch of comedians who are going to talk about it because that's what they do. I mean, I was sad she was upset, but I it wasn't like we didn't do it again the next night, you know?
Well, I think it was James O'Brien's point where everybody finds everything funny until it's about them.
Yeah.
And suddenly everything's going, hold on.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, the Maurice Meyer and the Majors story was the, you know, stutter rap was a joke about a rapper who had a stutter. You know, it's a very simple gag, the ridiculousness of that juxtaposition. But we only ever had about three complaints, but one of them was my mate stutters and I feel really angry for him. And he came backstage and we're going, you know, it's a gag, mate.
Did you know that the BBC... when it first came out, the BBC banned My Generation by The Who. Not because, you know, why don't you all... Not because they thought, oh, he's going to say fuck and he didn't... There's a kind. They did it because they banned it because they were afraid it would offend stutterers.
No, is that true? That's a great story. I didn't know that. Well, fantastic. Oh, yeah, that's brilliant. Have you ever gotten yourself out of trouble by using humour? Now, I suspect on stage that's a given that you do that,
yeah.
But in other aspects of your life?
Probably not since I was a kid. I mean, there were occasions, you know, just a class. It's almost a cliche, you know, you make the school bully laugh and then they won't steal your dinner money. There was a bit of that. So, you know, this guy who broke me flask and would always hit me in the queue for dinner, I would end up just doing an impression of the football teacher or the physics teacher, and he, you know, he'd laugh at that and he wouldn't steal me dinner money. I mean, you know, that's such a cliche, isn't it? But
well, no, but it's true because, you know, I think I used it all the time at school. Yeah. I mean, I think you went to a comprehensive as well, didn't you?
It was a state grammar school, yeah.
Great grammar school, yeah. I went to a comprehensive, big comprehensive. We had 2,000 boys.
Yeah.
You know, you had to have something that was in your armory to diffuse that. And you build on that throughout your life, don't you? It's just, you know, that stuff you learned early on. Now in business, is it survival of the fittest or survival of the funniest?
It's hard to think that we could ever get to a stage where it would literally be survival of the funniest. It'd be nice because the point is there's a sort of an implication with survival of the fittest that fittest also means most ruthless and cruelest and most sociopathic. And it's no accident that I think that studies have shown that an awful lot of people who are hugely successful in business also tick an awful lot of boxes in the psychopath test because, you know, lack of empathy helps when you're firing somebody or you're stepping on somebody to get a little bit further up the corporate ladder. I suspect it probably still is survival of the fittest, sadly.
Within books, is that world different? You know, I mean, you said it was very sort of supportive.
It's no different to any other industry, really, Paul, except it's very polite. It's extremely polite and rather old-fashioned. Let's think of a situation where an agent is trying to sell one of their clients' books. You know, this is a very common thing. You have an agent, and especially if you're a new author. So a new author signs with an agent, and that agent then contacts lots of publishers to see if they want to buy the book. It would be the easiest thing in the world for an agent to say to HarperCollins, well, Random House have offered 150,000, so that, you know, HarperCollins then say, all right, we'll offer 160,000, when there is no such offer, right? But I've never come across one who would do that because I just go, oh, that's not done. We wouldn't do that. That'd be a terrible thing to do. So it's a very polite industry, but they're fine and nice and supportive and lovely as long as you're doing well. And I've been with the same publisher for over 20 years and they've always been lovely to me. That's because I've always sold books for them. You're only as good as your last couple of books. I'd have plenty of friends who have been dropped ruthlessly and without mercy when, you know, the book stopped selling. It can be a ruthless business.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just any business can be ruthless, can't it, really? And it's about success, and you've been enormously successful within your business. What does success mean to you? Is it about the work now?
Yeah, it's about the work now. I mean, there's, you know, I'm a strong believer in the harder I work, the luckier I get. You have to use that luck and run with it. You know, and then you suddenly have once you have a fan base, once you have people who you know are going to buy your books. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I'm not saying that I could turn out garbage now for the rest of my life and it would continue to sell, but there are plenty of high profile authors selling lots of books who have been phoning it in for a very long time. And you're aware of that. And so you just think, I'm still trying to write the best book I can. There comes a point when you might go, my best book was 10 years ago. It's like Usain Bolt. I always have a feeling that Usain Bolt at some point is going to go, that's as fast as I can bloody run. That's it. It happened 3 years ago, you know, in Munich, and that's it. I'm never going to get any faster. He's always going to try, but I think you have to have that ambition. So, yeah, success for me means, thankfully, I've got a platform where I now have a right to fail.
Is there still, because I think all successful people are driven. You touched on that, and as a psychologist, I was like going, is that imposter syndrome is still there?
God, yes. Of course it is. You're constantly waiting for that little tap on the shoulder going, there's been a hideous administrative error. We were supposed to give that book deal to Mike Bellingham and it was just a typo. No, absolutely. And I've seen that from writers a zillion times more successful than I am, from your Lee Childs and your John Grishams and your, you know, they all have that. They all have that. And they also don't take themselves that seriously, which is it's great to see that. Really. And they're also very supportive of people coming up behind them. You know, and again, in a way I never really saw in comedy. You know, you're very few big comedians saying to the new act, that was brilliant, you know, fantastic, mate. There's more a kind of, I'm watching you. But no, the really successful authors tend to be very supportive of the newer authors.
Well, but there's a model for comedy to start taking on, really. They'll never do that, obviously, but we come to the part of the show which we like to call quickfire questions.
Oh, okay.
Quickfire questions.
Who is the funniest business person you've ever met?
Oh, Lord.
Now, given that your business was comedy for years, I suppose you could veer over to somebody in comedy if you think, but I'm trying to push you.
I know plenty of crime writers. Well, I know plenty of crime writers who are just hilariously funny. There's a wonderful Irish writer called John Connolly who writes incredibly dark supernatural crime. Incredibly dark and you know, touching and whatever, but he's just, you go out for a night in the pub with him and you won't stop laughing. Just hilariously funny, just naturally gifted sort of, you know, raconteur. And you can't teach that. That's just who he is.
What book makes you laugh?
I knew this question was coming, so I've got it to show you. It's this book. It's a book called The Law of the Playground, right? Which I picked up. It's a good 10 years old. And I laughed so hard at this book. I would read it in bed every night that eventually it made my wife angry. And she said, stop that. Nothing's that funny. It's incredible. It says on the front, a puerile and disturbing dictionary of playground insults and games. And it's basically just the stuff we did at school, the stupid rituals, the stupid nicknames. And the other thing that was very funny is I have a very funny memory of buying it. It is hilarious, but a funny memory of buying it. As you can see from the jacket, right? It's got that on the front. And when I went to buy the book, I couldn't find it in the shop. And I asked a shop assistant if they could find it. And they pulled it off the shelf and went, there you go. And they went, oh, I'm terribly sorry. Somebody's drawn on this. And I thought, do I tell them that's actually the jacket design or do I try and get a discount? But the law of the playground. I mean, I laughed like a drain on every page.
So, all that schoolboy humour is still there, isn't it?
Well, it's because just... also it also keys into nostalgia. It's that thing about not just the laugh at the funny thing, but the memory that evokes and everything comes together. I could not stop laughing. And I was laughing like I was 11 in the playground. You know, the fact that we called that teacher that name or we play, it was just a joy.
Absolutely. Regression. Yeah. Well, that's regression therapy.
Now, you know, bear in mind, we're going back to the 1970s. You know, some of the things we did and said and whatever, very much not be acceptable now. But, you know, we're talking 40 years ago, 50 years ago.
What film makes you laugh?
Probably have to be This Is Spinal Tap, which, you know, I can watch. One of those films that any time it's on, you find it and you go, I'll watch it. And there's I'll laugh at it again, however many times I've heard the jokes.
Well, you see, it is my favourite film as well. And it's no surprise that we both have a music background as well. There's always a new line and there's always an appropriate line for any situation. Yeah. You know, it's a very fine line between clever and stupid, you know.
And whenever, with this band of crime writers I'm in now, whenever we walk from the dressing room to the stage, somebody will go, just a little jog to the left. Somebody will say that, you know. The Fun-Loving Crime Writers and Puppet Show. It's I never tire of watching it.
This is our new direction.
Yeah.
Mark Billy Lee wrote this one.
Whenever we have a band meeting about something, somebody will also go, if I could just raise a practical point, are we going to play Stonehenge? No, we're not going to fucking play Stonehenge. Somebody will do that at every band meeting.
It's funny, I had Mark Bedford on from Madness and we go, you must join us for a lunch one day and you'll have nothing but Spinal Tap for the whole lunch. Oh, what word makes you laugh, Mark?
I couldn't think of a particular word, Paul. I mean, it would be something juvenile. It would be a swear word quite probably. And what would make me laugh is the way it upsets people. I never get tired of the complaints and emails I get about bad language in my books. And a writer I've already mentioned, Chris Brookmeyer, he and I do, as part of the show we do, we just sit and read these things out. People who pick up a book, I mean, they'll pick up a book and go, what's in this? Oh, murder, rape, child abuse, all my favourites. Oh, swearing, heavens no. And you just go, how messed up are you? And I find that funny. Yeah, so I'd probably just laugh at the word fuck because I'm a child.
No, but it's got a hard K and always funny.
Always
funny. Taking a shift right over to the other side, what's not funny?
I don't think anything's not funny. I was thinking about this a lot. When you take something out of racism is not funny until you hear Richard Pryor talking about it. It as a thing is not funny, but that doesn't mean you can't be funny about it. And I think that applies. And it all depends who's telling the jokes. It all depends, you know, if somebody's punching up or punching down, who the target of the joke is, all that stuff, of course. So I don't think there is anything that you can't, you know, murder isn't funny, but plenty of people write comedy crime novels about it, and plenty of people will read them and laugh about it. You're still talking about murder at the end of the day. The Holocaust isn't funny until you hear a brilliant Jewish comedian talking about it, you know?
So context.
And in a way, you have to laugh. You know, it's that thing of tragedy plus time, you know, we all know that. But
yeah.
I don't think there is anything that's off limits. If the joke is funny enough and the target of that joke is the right target of the joke. And
it's funny because we all have our own personal things that we don't like, though, don't we? Where we go, no, that makes me feel uncomfortable.
Yes, to give you an analogy, I remember when I had very young kids, I didn't want to write about violence against children. But I was well aware of that. But it was a very personal thing. I don't want to read about it. I don't want to write about it. But I also knew that there are other people who should be and were doing that very well, you know, because it is a subject that should be written about. Just for me, at that moment in my life, because I was surrounded by young children, well, I had a couple of them, I didn't want to do it. But I think there's always room for somebody to do the thing you find distasteful.
Would you rather be considered clever or funny?
Funny. All day long, both on a magic island, but yeah, funny.
But do you not think that in order to be funny, you have to be clever?
I don't know, because there are so many different types of funny. There's people who are linguistically funny, which I always appreciate. I've never been a massive fan of slapstick, for example, but somebody who is clever with words will always make me laugh. I'll always appreciate a good funny column in a newspaper.
Would you consider Laurel and Hardy slapstick?
I suppose, and there's no question whatsoever that Stan Laurel was a comedy genius. I mean, absolutely no question at all that he was hugely clever, and he couldn't have been that funny without it. I know, I think maybe you can't be funny without being clever. So there you go. I'd like to be funny, which means I'm also clever.
It's a double whammy. Perfect. And finally, desert island gags. You can only take one gag with you to a desert island. What would it be?
It's such a toss-up. I've always had a fondness for Jewish humour because I had, through some strange quirk of schooling in Birmingham growing up, I had an Orthodox Jewish education. I was at an Orthodox Jewish junior school. So I grew up surrounded by that, you know, I would go see my friends on a Friday night, and I'd be at the sort of Sabbath meal with all my friends, and I had to, you know, I wore a yarmulke. I mean, I'm not Jewish, right? But it's a very strange story. But so I was always drawn to Jewish humour, and they're two very simple Jewish jokes. Are you going to make me choose?
Okay, no, so, you can.
Okay,
you can.
So it's the old guy that goes into a restaurant every single day at the same time, and he has been doing it for 30 years, and he always orders the same thing. He has a bowl of chicken soup every day. Has a chicken soup, he pays and leaves. Always the same, every day, regular as clockwork. In he comes. Comes in one day, and they go, oh, chicken soup. And the waiter always comes over and goes, how's the soup? And he goes, lovely. And he comes over on this one day and goes, you know, how is it? And the old man goes, taste the soup. And the waiter is horrified. I mean, it's absolutely horrified. He goes, oh my God, is there something wrong? Is it not warm enough? And he goes, taste the soup. And he goes, it's the new chef. Oh my God, we got a new chef in. He's put too much salt in. I warned him about the salt. Is it too much? Taste the soup. Is there not enough chicken? Is he not put enough chicken? Taste the soup. And so the waiter leans down and sees, and he goes, oh, you haven't got a spoon. And the guy goes, aha. I just think that's hilarious. Hilarious joke. Very similarly is a guy who goes into a sort of Jewish grocer's and he's trying to buy, I don't know what he's trying to buy, a bottle of olive oil. And all the way up the aisles, all he can see are huge sacks of salt. There's salt down there. There's salt up there. He goes into the next aisle and it's just salt, salt, salt. And he goes up to the guy behind the counter and he goes, why is there so much salt? And the guy goes, ah. Well, you see, me, I can't sell salt. But the guy who sells me salt, oi, can he sell salt? I just love that joke so much. So it would be a toss-up between those two.
Oh, both brilliant as you are. Mark Billiam, thank you so much for being on the Humorology podcast.
It's been a pleasure.
The Humorology podcast was hosted by Paul Barros and produced by Simon Banks. Music by Steve Hayworth, creative direction by Les Hughes, and additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky production.
Hold up.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.